Live from Chicago, this is Chris Roebling. I'm sitting in for the vacationing Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, sometimes professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, we're featuring commentary by our friends Republican Chris Dudley, Democrat Bob Cramer, and in hour two, Dr. Stanley Kurtz, author of Radical in Chief, Barack Obama, and The Untold Story of American Socialism, will be joining us. Our program this evening coming to you from our home base at the offices of the Museum of Broadcast Communications on Chicago's beautiful Near North Side. Our toll-free phones are now open, 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. We'll be taking our calls from you a little bit later in the hour. But right now we want to welcome, as I say, our guest Christine Dudley, longtime Republican consultant extraordinaire. Yes.
Oh, very nice. Thank you. Happy New Year.
Former Republican National Committee Regional Political Director for the Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And Bob Cramer, longtime Liberal Democrat activist and consultant.
Yes.
And it's great to have you both. And Happy New Year to you and Happy New Year to all of our listeners and Bruce Dumont, wherever he is right now.
I hope it's warm.
I'm quite sure it is. It's also going to get, there's going to be an increase in temperature down in Washington now that the holidays are over. People are going to have to get back down to business. We've got a few big issues down there, and we've got some new conditions. The big issues are the same, but the conditions have changed. Republicans like you, Christine Dudley, have taken over the United States House of Representatives, and they've increased their number in the United States Senate. But the Senate still has a Democratic majority, and Bob Cramer, your friend Barack Obama.
Yes.
A personal friend of yours.
I know the president. I'm not close to him. I met him.
is still in charge at the White House.
He is indeed.
All right. So what's going to happen? We're going to talk about that mainly in hour two. But let's just give a little preview, and then we'll talk about lessons learned from 2010 in hour one. Are we going to see an outbreak of harmony and bipartisanship to solve the issues confronting our country? Bob Cramer?
I think the president is going to take a strong, principled leader kind of position. He's going to advocate positions that are progressive positions, but he's going to, on the other hand, be in a position where he will do the best he can to assure that we actually have progress, particularly with respect to the economy, which is the critical, central be-all, end-all of the next 2 years.
And Christine Dudley, your Republican friends, and you are a personal friend of every Republican who is elected to...
I don't know about that. I'm getting so old, I don't recognize half the faces in the new biographies.
Now, are your Republican friends, newly taking office in Washington this very week, are they going to be working in harmony and in concert with Barack Obama down at the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue?
I think, you know, at the end of the day, if you look at this from a political science standpoint and the framers and the Constitution, it's actually kind of a nice construct of things in that you've got, you know, the checks and balances in place. I think John Boehner is going to be a very, very, very good speaker. And I think what I'm hearing is the word common ground a lot, not consensus, not capitulation, but the word common ground. And today, one of the most important things that I think that people were talking about and what Republicans on some of the major shows is the word trade. And to Bob's point, Bob Cramer's point, that has an impact on the economy and what we're going to be looking at in terms of the economic conditions moving forward. So I think finding at the center point a common ground, maybe that will be trade in these first quarter, to understand how that will be able to allow us to enhance our economy. But I think both sides will be principled, but I think there are pragmatic politicians in John Boehner and Barack Obama. Harry Reid, he's going to have to herd the cats a little bit differently over on the Senate side. But all in all, I think it's going to be a good start, but it's going to be principled and pragmatic.
All right. More on 2011 in our second hour, which will be starting at 7 o'clock Central Time. And that's when we'll be joined by Stanley Kurtz, author of a new book about Barack Obama. But let's get back to 2010 for a quick second and talk about it a little more this hour. Bob, what was the most important story out of 2010 that the Beltway misunderstood.
The Beltway misunderstood?
Right, because this show is beyond the Beltway. Right. So the Beltway makes mistakes
here's the principal thing I think that is misunderstood about the outcome of the election. The election outcome was about the economy. I mean, the bottom line was that we won, that is Democrats won, people who said they were worse off economically in 2008 by 40 points. We lost that same cohort by 29 points in this last election. It was entirely about the economy, a 70-point swing among people who felt they were worse off today. The reading in the Beltway is this stuff about how, oh, it's the deficit, it's government size. And so, no, it's about productivity of government, whether or not the government is going to deliver for me, average citizen, in terms of my economic circumstances. And I think the other thing is, when it comes to this big issue of long-term federal spending, you know, there are a lot of ways to close the long-term structural deficit that has opened up largely a result of the fact that we had two wars that didn't get paid for in the recent economic disaster. But none of them should be paid for by the middle class, because the middle class has not done well at all in the last 20 years. And those who had the party ought to be paying the bill, and that is the top 1-2% of the American population.
Well, let's get back to test that in a couple of minutes. But, Chris, your view of the most misunderstood story of 2010 inside the Beltway.
Well, I think that even though a lot has been written and discussed about the health care reform package, I think that inside the Beltway there really wasn't that understanding once the package passed, the reverberations that it had across the country. Every poll that I saw and all the campaigns that I worked with, and I spent a lot of time traveling about the Midwest and doing a lot of work. Healthcare was on the minds of everyone, and the idea that government was going to have the whole concept of takeover of their personal healthcare. It was very deep seated and tied to the economy, because people were looking at the uncertainty of what does this mean for their own economic conditions. And I think that, again, while a lot was written about it, it was very complex in its nature and remains complex. I don't think the Beltway quite grasped the reverberations that package had in its simplicity just to the common person out there.
Okay, I want to ask you then a related question. If all three of us agree the Beltway gets things wrong, Chris, Christine Dudley, my question for you as the Republican on tonight's program is the following. Do you think John Boehner, who you said a moment ago will be a good speaker, do you think that Mitch McConnell, who seems to be a very capable minority leader over in the United States, have they learned lessons from times when, say, the Democrats were in control of everything in 2009, but then they got a shellacking the next time they went out? The Republicans were in charge of everything except for the White House in 1994. Then they got a shellacking. Have they learned lessons to have their act pulled together and actually put numbers on the board for their constituency?
Well, I think that the bigger question is, not 2006, but 2008. And I'm going to turn the question around and say that the Democrats missed 2006. We got our butts kicked.
The Republicans did.
Absolutely. But in 2008, I think the Democratic caucus just made a determination that this was a mandate for progressive politics. And in 2010, guess what? That wasn't the case.
Bob Kramer is going to be back to answer that just after these words. This is Beyond the Beltway, 723-8289. Give us a call, 800. And this is Beyond the Beltway, sitting in for Bruce Dumont. My name is Chris Roebling. We're welcoming Democrat Bob Kramer and Republican Christine Dudley. Next hour, Stanley Kurtz is going to join us. More on that at the bottom of the hour. So let's get back to this, Bob. Chris Dudley was saying just before the break that there was a misinterpretation on the part of the Democrats in 2008 that influenced what they then did in 2009 and then led to the shellacking in 2010. Now, you've already talked a little bit about the economy, but if what you say is true, why weren't the Democrats gaining numbers in 2010?
Well, I think the entire explanation of the problems in 2010 was the economy. I mean, people are feeling that their futures are not what they want them to be. And until people personally feel that they and their brother-in-law and their their son and daughter are going to have better economic circumstances in the future or feel that it's improving in that way, you know, I think that's a serious problem. That's why the top priority for the president has got to be making the economy grow, or at least having its trajectory increasing by 2012 if he wants to be reelected.
Well, but
and I think that's what he's going to do.
And I don't just, but the ramifications of 2012 go far deeper than the Capitol Hill. I mean, you look at the legislative component around there. 680 seats were picked up by Republicans, and
in the legislatures,
okay. And that was the first time since 1928. I mean that number the swing had gone that far for the Republicans in that sense, and also you know. That the governorships that were picked up, and I've been on this show for many, many years, and I've always been a big proponent of the governors. I mean, I think the president has an obligation. He is the leader of this country. He, his heart is in the right place to change the economy, but it also has to be in concert with the governors. And again, coming back to my thesis that 2008 was not this, you know, everybody was in this euphoria thinking, oh, we can take all these policies and these progressive policies and implement them. And it was a repudiation because the Democrats, I think, went too far too fast.
This election had nothing to do with repudiating health care or the Wall Street reform, which is very popular even today. I mean, absolutely popular. Or attempts to deal with the problem of global warming or any of the other issues. I mean, the Don't Ask, Don't Tell bill passed in the lame duck. It, you know, is supported by 70% of the population. Most of the progressive platform is totally mainstream. In fact, you know, on the healthcare front, had we got a public option, that was favored by 70% of the voters. And we'd have had a more popular health care bill. It wasn't the progressive agenda that was rejected in this last election. It was the fact that the economy, which had been sunk by the Republican policies in Wall Street, had not recovered adequately. And people said, you know, gee whiz, you know, I want somebody who's going to take care
of
business.
All right, Bob, I want to then probe this with you and find out where you think the Democrats went wrong. Let's just say that you're correct, okay? And I'm not sure that you are, and I might personally disagree. But let's say that you are correct. Then between the inauguration and the midterm elections, where did Harry Reid, Barack Obama, and Nancy Pelosi go wrong?
I think there are
wrong?
Two things probably that we could have done better that would have substantially improved our chances in the last election. One is that we should have proposed a much more substantial stimulus program at the beginning of the year.
Okay, now how?
I mean, there was
more
a
substantial in what way?
More money. There was a $3 trillion
more
deficit.
More than 780.
There was a $3 trillion deficit in demand in the economy. The problem is not we don't have a lot of people to work. The problem is there was no demand in the economy. It collapsed the same way it has in other circumstances similar. And
so instead of 790
we should have had
billion,
at least twice that.
And
the president would have done better. In retrospect, I think to have started the whole process by saying we have a national tragedy. It's going to take huge amounts of effort.
Okay.
It's not going to be solved overnight. The other thing I think we could have done better is to have framed up more clearly the cause of the problem, which were the policies of Wall Street and the policies of the previous administration.
Okay. I want to ask you then, since you raised the question of the stimulus, I want to ask you if you had a problem with the way in which the $790, give or take, billion dollars was spent. And let me give you my, and I've said this on the program before, I was raised a Democrat. I couldn't believe when this thing finally came around that they went to Jim Oberstar, who was then the chairman of transportation, and they said, what have you got ready to go? And he came up with $35 billion of programs. He and David Obey agreed to the $35 billion. And instead of mass transit being funded, instead of bridge and gutter being funded, instead of highways being funded, we had this $780 or $90 billion program, and only $35 billion of which was real curb and gutter infrastructure. And the rest of it was kind of social programs that couldn't have gotten funded, or that were not funded in the prior 10, 15 years. Did that bug you?
Well, no. I mean, I tell you, the thing that did bug me the most was that $190 billion of this was the AMT fix, the alternative minimum tax fix, that had no stimulative effect because we'd been fixing it every year for the last 10, So there wasn't any increase in overall demand being caused as a consequence. And that was a result of the fact that we had to get 60 votes in the Senate. I mean, because the Senate, as a broken institution, continues to require these 60 votes because the Republican Party, with all due respect, has tried to block everything and had more filibusters in the last 2 years than any time in the history of the institution.
Okay. All right. So, all right. Let's get back to that. Chris, your loyal opposition for the past 2 years, what's your evaluation of Bob's explanation? Was it a case of not going far enough, of the stimulus being too half-hearted, needing to be doubled in size?
Well, I think, you know,
was that the problem, and that the, enough blame was not heaped on the Bush administration?
I guess I'd have to, you know, go to the Winston Churchill, you know, quote that we are all familiar with, is democracy is the system to which we choose those who will take the blame. And in the last 2 years, I think the stimulus, I mean, again, you it's a matter of viewpoint, and the stimulus, it was not really a stimulus, to your point, Chris Roebling. It was a maintenance program to keep states alive. We were giving money out to the states to keep them operating. I'm not arguing, you know.
I mean, jobs.
To you know, infrastructure, if you go back to the New Deal, if you go back to the Eisenhower administration, if you go back in history, you know, stimulus and infrastructure go hand in glove because they produce what? Jobs.
Right.
And 35 billion that you
35 billion.
35 billion between Mr. Oberstar and Mr. Obey. Okay, but I know that here in Illinois in particular, you look at our infrastructure needs and you look at our labor force, the operating engineers and all of the other people who are involved in those kinds of programs. I mean, we've got a modicum of things that had happened, but the stimulus really was a maintenance. There was a lot of waste in that stimulus. And if businessmen across the country that I spoke to were horrified by the whole aspect of the stimulus. And one of the main reasons that they were fired up, we talked about this at break, they were more motivated to be involved this time around, is they saw this building debt and deficit
Let's be clear, though. You know, virtually every mainstream economist in the country thinks that the stimulus generated or saved something between 2.8 and 3.5 million jobs that otherwise would not be in the economy.
But they're government jobs.
No, they weren't government jobs. Most of them were private sector jobs. Most of them were private sector jobs. In fact, most of the growth in the economy in the last 2 years has been private sector jobs. There have been more private sector jobs created in the last 2 years than all of the Bush administration, all of it.
I have heard that, but let's talk about politics. Let's not talk about economics. I want to probe Bob. Don't you think, honest engine, don't you think that elements of the progressive agenda, which you claim is mainstream, and you know, let's just say for the sake of conversation, it's mainstream. But if it is mainstream, don't you also concede that elements of that agenda, once revealed to the public, caused a lot of people to get very committed in their fight against the agenda?
There is no doubt.
Okay, that, the Tea Party,
the health care bill. Yeah, I mean, the health care bill motivated the Republican base.
Anxiety. Talking about people who hadn't even been involved for years.
Here are senior citizens. Why were senior citizens unhappy with the health care bill? Because they were convinced by millions and millions of dollars of advertising that it cut Medicare by half a trillion dollars, which of course was not true, but it didn't matter. It was repeated over and over and over and over. Medicare, by the way, a very progressive, Democratic program that turned out to be one of the principal issues that was used by the Republicans in the last election.
Well, at the end of the day, you're complaining about the millions and millions and millions of dollars. Where was the alternative conversation coming from this White House, coming from Nancy Pelosi, coming from? I mean, clearly there was a disconnect between what was going on in America and what was going on in Washington into this convoluted healthcare scheme that didn't involve some of the very basic tenets that I think the Republicans were trying to put forth, which was, you know, having health care across state lines and tort reform and other aspects of it that people could
Chris,
put their
around. What do you dislike about the health care bill? I assume the mandate is one thing.
Well, I think that's why. And I think that they're also tied together. Somebody says take away the mandate. Pre-existing conditions. I'll concede that. Good.
How do you do pre-existing conditions if you don't require everyone to have insurance?
But everyone having insurance, people, the anxiety out there about – about the issue. A lot of people are going to opt out because it's about individuality and freedom.
Yeah, look, the problem is if you don't have...
But
it's
a mandate telling people what they have to
do. But the problem is it's simple.
Everybody
in America will one day or the other need to have health care. The question is, how do they pay for it? And if somebody says, I'm not going to pay for it until I get sick... Then you can't.
You know what? That's what's going to happen.
Now, I want to hold on now. Let's hold that thought. And I also want to say that this program is not just Jump on Bob Night.
No. Bob's so good at defending his viewpoint.
When we get back, it's going to be Jump on Chris
Night.
There you go. And we're going to talk about the Republicans and their manifest failures and whether or not they've drunk the Kool-Aid and are now going to come a cropper of the same issues that sunk the Democrats in the 2010.
And we're talking about the Washington Republicans.
I'm telling
and the Washington
you, we want to hear about it right here. Stay tuned. Sitting in for Bruce Dumont on Beyond the Beltway, this is Chris Roebling. Tonight, we're looking back at 2010 and ahead to 2011. Joining us, Democrat Bob Cramer, Republican Christine Dudley. In this hour, we're talking pretty much about 2010. Next hour, 2011, and we're going to be joined by Dr. Stanley Kurtz, author of Radical in Chief, Barack Obama and the Untold Story of American Socialism. Dr. Kurtz's book states what he considers to be the documentary case for concluding that Barack Obama is, in fact, a socialist. And in that text, a co-star is none other than our guest tonight, Bob Cramer. Bob, have you and Stanley ever discussed this book?
Not to my knowledge, no.
We have it on good, sources that he's listening right now. And you guys are going to be able to chat about it on the air with a national radio audience in just 40 minutes.
A pleasure.
I think that's going to be a lot of fun.
Look forward to it.
Christine Dudley, Republicano extraordinaire. I want to ask you, as a fellow Republican, do you think our guys down there in D.C. have learned a gosh darn thing, or are they going to drink the Kool-Aid, come on, in a way that alienates everybody so that the whole public tosses them out? I personally believe that the Tea Party is not a Republican. I think friends of Bob's said a lot in 2010. I'm not saying that you said it, but a lot of friends of Bob's said, oh, it's just a Republican AstroTurf cola. I don't think it is at all.
I know
I think
it's
independent, does its own thing, makes its call, and they are not going to stay. They started by attacking George Bush for what they perceived to be overspending. I think they'll attack Republicans if they don't see Republicans.
Oh, I totally agree with that. I mean, I was in Indiana a lot this year working with now Senator-elect Dan Coats. Who came back to Indiana to run for the Senate seat that he had held before and so forth and so on. And I will tell you, the Tea Party was the most skeptical. I was my first introduction to them working in the campaign. They were incredibly skeptical, in some ways a little bit naive, some of their organizers, but really good, solid, decent people. But they weren't about the infrastructure of either party. They weren't about, those of us who are the political, and I will call everybody around this table the political elite, because we actually know how the levers work and the process works and all of those things. And yes, we are, because this is how we live and consume our days. These are just hardworking Americans who will repudiate and call into question anybody. Because they tend to be more conservative in the way that they look, in their viewpoint, they're part of the Republican team. But I think that this Congress in particular, I don't know. Did they drink the Kool-Aid? Will we see? I think the governor, again, I come back to, I think the leadership for our party, with the president being on the opposing party, really comes out of the governors, really comes out of especially Midwest governors and seasoned governors. So we will see this partnership forming that I think Boehner has tried to pull together with the governors to come with some solutions. But the Tea Party, they're going to call out what they think it's a foul.
Well, Bob, have the Republicans learned any lessons, or do you think they're going to go down some sort of path that alienates the people who just put them in office, gave them so much power down in Washington?
Well, I think if they continue to do what they've done the last 2 years, having control now in control of the House, that will be the case. But you know, it's interesting, the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party. I mean, I understand. I mean, they certainly are a wing of the party's
how
base.
How is that, Bob? I mean, seriously. You know, I mean,
let's remember how they started. It was Dick Armey, former Majority Leader of the House, Republican Majority Leader.
No, actually, it started on the floor of the CME.
Started
with Rick Santelli saying, "Well, we're going to have a Tea Party."
One at a time.
In any case, I mean, I think, you know, it'll be a, there will be a problem. And one of the places is we're going to seize the debt limit.
Yeah, I want to get to that.
Where a lot of these people will say, well, we're not going to vote for an increased debt unless there's all these draconian changes. But I tell you, if the Republicans hold hostage the good faith and credit of the United States to a bunch of stuff, even some of the Republican Party's most real base on Wall Street is going to go crazy.
Our phone number, 1-800-723-8289, 1-800-723-8289 on Beyond the Beltway. This is Chris Roebling sitting in for Bruce Dumont, and we're going to want to hear from you, especially about 2010. If your calls or comments or questions are about 2011, hold off for a few minutes. Come back to us next hour. 1-800-723-8289. We'll be taking calls in a few minutes. Bob Cramer, you raised the debt limit vote, and I remember from being a congressional staff doobie 30,000 years ago.
You and I both.
How newly elected Reagan baby Republicans mm-hmm. were anti-debt limit.
Oh, absolutely.
And they washed into Washington, and then the wave receded, and they're all still there, and they're all saying, we're going to vote against the debt limit. And folks had to say, hold on a second. This is not the vote where you stop the spending because we've already obligated ourselves here.
Right. Exactly.
And they had to go through that. And I am seeing, Chris, I was seeing today on, I don't know, the ABC program with a new congressperson from Pennsylvania. I think that same conversation that I saw 30 years ago was going on this morning.
Oh, yeah. It sounded like a repeat. One of the things that I saw this morning was Daryl Issa, who is, that's going to be a very interesting committee to take a look at in government oversight and whether or not they will truly do what he says that they're supposed to do, which is to take the pieces of government and investigate them for waste, fraud, and abuse. And I think that coming back to the issue of commonality, you know, the debt, waste, all of those things, they have to have a balance to them. And you can't have just one vote without other reorganization. Now, I don't want to say we don't want to move the boxes around, but everybody's really got to look at all the complexities of government and government funding. I don't know. This issue about the debt, Bob, you're exactly right. It's going to be a big issue. Chris, you're right. I think we're hearing a repeat of what we heard 30 years ago. The stakes are a little higher this time as it relates to the economy. So I think that debate is going to hopefully be a thoughtful one before people rush out and make decisions.
I think a very serious problem on the Republican side is the divergence of opinion between individuals who think that if you grow government, you are necessarily reducing liberty and reducing mm-hmm. jobs.
Yes.
And I'm pretty much in that camp. I think that at this point, if we keep growing government, then you're going to reduce the ability of the private sector to lead us out of this. A good news story for me as a Republican today was watching Austin Goolsbee on the ABC program. He was on with Jake Tapper saying we've got to have private investment lead us out of this. Because if we don't have private investment, there's $15 trillion sitting in the bank.
And there we
if they don't start investing
the difference
investing
between
that,
you and me, or the difference between at least a lot of Republicans and what I would say, is what causes private investment to happen? Only one thing, demand in the economy. Consumers who want to spend their money on product. Because investors don't make investments because they get a tax break or something. They make an investment because somebody's going to buy the product that investment generates.
Right, right. Let's
and
get a phone
call.
And
that's a global economy as opposed to 30 years ago, what you were talking about, Chris, which was a little more narrow in focus, and we were just starting
to
grow
that
into
means,
the
that means
the demand doesn't have to be also be from the United States. It's from across the globe.
Well, here right. in this country, it means we've got to have money in the hands of average people, not just the rich.
Our phone number, 800-723-8289. It's Beyond the Beltway. Christine Dudley, Bob Cramer. My name's Chris Roebling, sitting in for Bruce Dumont. We're joined now by Ted out in Boise, Idaho. Ted, you were probably cheering yesterday for TCU in the Rose Bowl as a surrogate for Boise State. Best of luck.
Yeah,
congratulations.
Yes, that was a terrific game.
That was all right.
Chris, I know your time is limited. I want to make two quick points.
Go ahead.
One, I was in, you're talking about 2010. I was terribly disappointed that the Obama administration has not made the economy priority from day one. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, he has no credibility in saying that he's going to focus on the economy when the first thing he did was so far out of sight of trying to improve this economy is beyond the pale. And number two, all the credit that people are leveling at Obama for this lame duck session on all on the legislation that was passed, it was completely contradictory to what the electorate said in November. They were never passed. Starting tomorrow, it would never have passed. His priorities would never have passed. So I just don't understand it. I cannot and will not trust this administration.
Ted, thank you very much for that call. Bob, why did it take Barack Obama 2 years to say job creation is at the center of his presidency?
You know, that's just wrong. I mean, the moment he took office, he faced an economic catastrophe unparalleled since the Great Depression. His principle that had been caused by the policies that a lot of these folks advocate.
Okay, but then
he spent enormous amount of time in political capital assuring that the financial system didn't collapse into a worse depression, A, and B, that we generated at least a substantial amount of demand in the economy through the stimulus.
Didn't they spend a lot of time talking about the nuances of health care, and didn't all of America sort of say, hey, wait a minute, we're looking for a job, why are you...
Let's be clear.
You got angels dancing on the head of a health care pin.
The health care issue affects a sixth of the economy,
okay,
and it's the need to control health care over the long haul, is health care costs, is one of the principal ways we're going to be competitive in the world in the future.
Another quick call before we break. Dan in Marshall, Illinois, you're on Beyond the Beltway with Chris Roebling sitting in for Bruce Dumont. Go ahead.
Yes, you're a Democratic supporter there, Mr. Kramer. His logic that the American public is really behind this Democratic legislative agenda and health care bill and cap and trade, not cap and trade, well, I don't know if he's saying cap and trade or not, but
he said the progressive agenda is mainstream. This is what Bob just said.
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
Yeah. This is Ray, and I was wondering.
We lost Dan. We lost Dan. Go ahead, Ray. Make a quick statement. Okay, we're having a little bit of trouble with the phone system tonight, but that's okay because we've got three people around the table who love to chat. Christine Dudley, our Republican, Bob Kramer, our Democrat, and Chris Roebling sitting in for Bruce Dumont. It's the New Year's gremlins. They've taken over here. Beyond the Beltway, we're going to be back in just a couple of minutes looking for more phone calls from you at 800-723-8289. That's 800-723-8289. Your calls make it happen right here at Beyond the Beltway. Beyond the Beltway is one for the history books, but before we say a final goodbye, tell us what you thought was its most important political event. It's Chris Roebling sitting in for Bruce Dumont, Bob Kramer, Democrat, Christine Dudley, Republican. We're going to go back to Ray, who's listening to us on our flagship station WLS right out of Chicago. Ray, quick point about 2010.
Well, actually, I'm listening on POTUS 130, but that's okay. I am in Chicago. But anyway, one of the things that I saw in 2010 is the rise of the fair tax movement. My personal views on this is that it would go ahead and redistribute the power back to the people inside the...
Tell us again, the fair tax movement, Ray, in your mind, is the one that does what?
Well, it eliminates the need to file complicated paperwork every April.
National sales tax, right?
It also eliminates the need to go ahead and take taxes out of our paychecks too.
That everyday people, working people, end up paying almost all the taxes, and the wealthiest people in the country pay even less.
Yeah, is there going to be major tax reform, Christine Dudley? How close is that to the top of the Republican agenda in
Washington? I think that it all comes down to this first quarter, and you know, we saw the mistake, to your point earlier in the first half of the show. I mean, one of the things the Obama administration, I think, did very incorrectly is they rushed into a lot of different complex things. Tax reform onto itself is needed, but it's a lot of things in life are timing, and I'm not sure that we're ready for that in this first quarter. Let's see where the economic conditions take it, but I do think it is something that is probably in the top 10.
We're now going to Jeannie, listening to us on KLBJ down in beautiful Austin, Texas. Jeannie, your point about 2010 before we say a final goodbye.
Oh, my gosh. Final 2010, I was so unhappy about the non-transparency President Obama had, and what I mean by that is, I just don't feel like all the money that was given to this entity, that entity, I just don't feel it was open records. And also, being an animal activist, President Obama, didn't do enough for animals. In 2010, Land Bureau management has way too much power. I don't get why we don't have transparency in that department. It just never, they're all too cozy, just like the oil spill with the minerals department. Too cozy. I'm tired of it.
And Jeannie, who do you think is going to be leading reform in Washington now? Will it be the congressional Republicans, President Obama, or the Senate?
Oh, gosh. You know, I actually got a letter from Kay Bailey's office that wasn't a pre-made letter that you get when you write these senators' letters.
Right.
I don't know, guys. But what I do know is, for myself, I am not going to stay quiet. I'm a Mexican-American that is wanting to get involved in so many other issues. My husband was out of work. I am an animal activist. We have a lot of things going on that President Obama needs. He's not in touch with the people, and this is what we said toward the end of Bush's reign. Wasn't in touch with the people.
All right.
And
Jeannie,
that's enough.
Jeannie of Austin, Texas, thanks very much for calling in. Bob Kramer, is Barack Obama out of touch with the people?
Well, when it comes to, say, the minerals department of the Department of Interior with respect to the drilling. I mean, we're talking about
the Deepwater Horizon spill.
The Deepwater Horizon. Yeah. We're talking about a legacy of the Bush administration. I mean, the Bush administration was owned lock, stock, and barrel by the oil industry, and we've tried our best to separate.
That is so such hyperbole. It takes my breath away.
Did the Bush administration report?
Jeannie made a really good point. Let's go back to the transparency issue. Barack Obama, if memory serves me, when Barack Obama was in the U.S. Senate, he co-sponsored with a senator from, I think, Oklahoma.
Okay, Tom Coburn.
Tom Coburn, yeah. Thank you. The whole issue of transparency, especially as it related to earmarks in the budget, and this was a president who talked about transparency.
No more earmarks.
We're going to have public hearings on the air. And then all this stuff, where is – I think Jeannie makes it – where is the
frankly,
transparency?
I think there will be a move for earmark
reform. Are you disappointed, Bob, that there wasn't more transparency?
I will say this. The earmark issue in general is a tiny issue relative to the entire budget. But I am in favor of total transparency when it comes to the earmark question, which has been abused by both parties substantially.
And to government in general.
Another call on this, the first hour Beyond the Beltway this Sunday night from Ann in Illinois. Ann, go ahead with your bottom line point about 2010.
I am a so-called independent. I voted for Obama. I voted this time Republican primarily because of the health care plan and his agenda. But the health care plan is my primary reason. And I'm getting dizzy from the spinning Mr. Bob's doing. Because the American people, everything I read and heard, the American people didn't want that. And saying it had to do with the public option is more spinning. And I'd like to ask him, where is the money coming from that he's saying there's no cuts to Medicare?
All right, Ann, thanks very much for calling. Bob, where is that money coming from if there are no cuts to Medicare?
Well, let me just tell you, the alleged cuts to Medicare were cuts to subsidies to private insurance companies that were making a lot of money on Medicare Advantage. There is no cut in Medicare benefits, which is what people care about and what they hear when you say you're cutting Medicare. Not a dime of cut to Medicare benefits.
But why cut Medicare Advantage? It was doing really well. People loved it.
It's continuing. It's continuing. The problem was that Medicare Advantage was set up with the allegation it would be cheaper than regular Medicare. It turned out that there was a huge subsidy paid per person to the Medicare Advantage in addition to what was paid to through normal Medicare, and the insurance companies made off with huge profits. That's what this is. The health care bill is about reining in the power of the big private insurance companies, not about forcing anybody to do anything.
Well, why can't we have competition,
costs.
Bob?
I'm in favor of competition. Why don't we want competition with a public option? How about having a public option as competition?
Because that is a mandate on my privileges and liberties.
No, it's not a mandate on anything.
Choose not to have insurance if I so choose.
The story about the public option is that if it is administered by the federal government and the federal government sets rules for everybody else, then eventually the federal government can set rules that dry up
the bottom
business
line
for everybody
the bottom
else.
Bottom line here is we want cheaper more efficient health care. We spend twice as much per person on health care in America than any other industrial country, and it's because it all goes to the insurance company.
Our bottom line is we've got to have more conversation after the top of the hour.
Okay.
All right, Christine Dudley. This is Chris Roebling sitting in for Bruce Dumont. It's Beyond the Beltway. Coming back, we'll have more with Bob Kramer, more with Christine Dudley, and also Stanley Kurtz, author of Radical in Chief. Stick with us. Welcome back to Hour 2 of Beyond the Beltway. Sitting in for Bruce Dumont, this is Chris Roebling. Tonight's program looking back at 2010 and now turning ahead to 2011. Our treasured guests, Republican Christine Dudley, Democrat Bob Kramer, and now joined by Stanley Kurtz of the Ethics and Public Policy Center and National Review Online. Dr. Kurtz has just published Radical in Chief, Barack Obama and the Untold Story of American Socialism, out from Threshold, Simon & Schuster, available everywhere. Thank you for joining us, Stanley. Stanley, before we get deep into 2011, let's use this segment to talk about Radical in Chief. What story do you tell in that book?
Well, Chris, Radical in Chief is a political biography of President Obama. It really flows from the research I did during the 2008 presidential election campaign, and that research helped inject the issues of Acorn and Obama's relationship with Bill Ayers into the campaign. And after that, I did some pretty systematic research in archives across the country. And what I discovered, to my amazement, really, was that the world of community organizing is a largely socialist world, particularly at the upper leadership levels, and particularly the community organizers who had contact with President Obama as he was climbing up the political ladder. So really, that's the story I tell in Radical in Chief, and then I argue in the final chapter that if you understand the ways in which socialism has changed since the 60s, the sophisticated new forms of socialism we have that don't simply propose nationalization of all industries immediately, then that brand of sophisticated socialism helps to make a lot of sense of President Obama's programs.
Yeah, Stanley, I want to probe with you on that point, that very point, for a second. I mean, I've spoken about your book with a lot of friends, and I've put some things on the web about it. And of course, you know, I read it a couple of months ago, just after it came out. And I keep getting the question, well, how can anybody say that person X, like, I know Chris Dudley, I've known her for 25 years, and it's been a great privilege. I know she's a Republican because she tells me she's a Republican. She signs all these Republican checks. She goes to Republican meetings and all this kind of stuff. How can you or any author come to a conclusion about someone like Barack Obama if he hasn't been out there doing the same things about socialism that Chris Dudley has done about her Republicanism?
Well, part of the answer, Chris, is that, as I say, socialism really has changed. It has a program that is in no way incompatible with what President Obama is doing. We have Harold Meyerson, an op-ed columnist who proudly calls himself a socialist and works completely within ordinary contemporary American politics. But another aspect of this, Chris, is that one of the discoveries I made was that community organizers of the socialist stripe have a very particular theory. Their idea is that you should not advertise your socialism, that you should keep it a secret and use it for your own strategic purposes, but instead speak of yourself as though you're an economic populist or a communitarian, or using terms from Saul Alinsky, let's say I want to democratize power instead of overtly saying I want to redistribute wealth. So people can judge the case that I make. They can agree or disagree, but it becomes necessary to at least argue that kind of a case when you see that Barack Obama spent so many years being trained and funded and having his political career sponsored by community organizers who were not only socialist, but who believed that you had to keep that socialism secret.
And as you know, someone who makes numerous appearances in your text joins us tonight right here at the table in Chicago, and it's Bob Kramer, who makes maybe a dozen or so appearances in the book. Bob's training institute, the Midwest Academy, dominates what I would call sort of the middle half, the second quarter and the third quarter of your book. Bob, what's your reaction to – now, I know you haven't read the book, have you?
Haven't, no. I guess I'll have to.
We got to get you a copy. You're all over.
I must have to. You know, there are two things I would say to Stanley's argument. One is that, you know, with all due respect, if you think that Barack Obama is a socialist – I mean, the only way you could conclude that is if you think Medicare and Social Security are socialist. And I know there are a lot of people who do, but that's not mainstream American. That's not in the mainstream American thought. I mean, he's a socialist only if that makes you a socialist, be for Medicare and Social Security. And, you know, it's almost, with all due respect, you know, laughable to say he's a socialist. He's a guy who believes in private markets. He also believes that government has a legitimate and important role in assuring that we have a strong future. Government, as Barney Frank says, is the things we choose to do together. The second thing I would say is that the use of the term socialist, you know, is, I think, unfortunately, intended in kind of almost intentionally to misrepresent. You know, if the Labour Party in Britain is socialist, I mean, it calls itself socialist. In the context of Europe, being a socialist is being a progressive Democrat. I mean, you're not for – but a lot of people, when they hear socialist, they think Joe Stalin or the Soviet Union. And that's not at all what we're talking about when you talk about the socialist parties of Europe or guys like Harold Meyerson and Democratic Socialists. You're talking about progressive Democrats, essentially, in a different context, in the European context. So, you know, and frankly, Barack Obama – is not as progressive as a lot of people who I know, whether it comes to a number of these questions, but he is a progressive in the broad sense.
Stanley, I guess Bob is saying there's a lot of mainstream overlap with liberal and progressive positions. This is a point he's been making about 2010. Are you being unfair in locating Barack Obama in that camp?
Well, those are great points that Bob made, Chris, and let me approach them one by one. There is overlap between the contemporary socialist program and the liberal program. In fact, the whole concept of the socialist-leaning community organizers who trained Barack Obama was to work within the Democratic Party, but to focus their political efforts and their political capital on the particular proposals already accepted by Democrats most likely to put the country on an irreversible path over the long term towards socialism. Healthcare reform, of course, is absolutely at the top of that list. Now, it's very interesting because, as I say in the book, and I deal with this at great length in the book, I explain very clearly that American socialism has changed since the 60s, that it's not the old-fashioned, strictly Marxist socialism. I'm very careful to explain that. And yet, at the same time, the community organizers who sponsored and mentored Obama, they retained a soft spot for classically Marxist regimes abroad, places like Cuba and Nicaragua. They didn't exactly hold that program for certain in the United States, but they hadn't fully abandoned their old Marxist ways either. And again, I deal with all of those complexities in the book. And again, I talk in the book, I'll give you one example, about the changes that came on socialism. You know, the socialists of the 60s were hoping for and even expected a revolution, and it took them about 10 or 15 years to realize that that wasn't going to happen. And they came up with a new plan. The idea was, instead of going from the top down through government nationalization, they would work from the bottom up through community organizing. So when Acorn went and got the banks to make subprime loans to people with risky credit histories, that was thought of by socialists as a de facto way of gaining public control of the economy.
And Stanley, we're going to hold it right there until the other side of this break. We'll get back to Acorn and its role in subprime and how that fits into your story. All of this taking place on Beyond the Beltway. Stick with us. For Bruce Dumont, this is Chris Roebling on Beyond the Beltway. Tonight, we've got Chris Dudley, the Republican, Bob Cramer, the Democrat, Stanley Kurtz, author. Stanley, you were making a point about how socialism in the United States had transmogrified in the 70s after a realization there wasn't going to be a revolution, and that somehow Acorn and what Acorn was doing with the subprime housing loans, mortgages, was indicative of that shift. Do you want it, let I want you to feel like you've completed that point before we continue on into 2011.
Sure, Chris. Well, there were a lot of people in a group called the Democratic Socialists of America who saw Acorn as a kind of prototype of this new form of socialism, socialism from the ground up. And one of the things I do for the book is to go in depth into the archives of Acorn at the Wisconsin Historical Society, and I show the way in which they were in on the ground floor of some of these policies that led to the subprime crisis, the way in which they consciously thought of themselves as being socialist, and perhaps most interesting, I show, I think, pretty conclusively that what Barack Obama said about his relationship with Acorn during the campaign just wasn't true, because I found extensive evidence of a relationship between President Obama and Acorn. And during the campaign, he really said the only thing he'd done was represent them in a single legal case.
So are you, Stanley, how would you portray your book to the listener of Beyond the Beltway? Would you say that this is a book for people who don't like Barack Obama already, or is this a book for people who care about the system, or who is it that you're writing for?
Well, you know, a writer at Slate, certainly a mainstream and even a very liberal publication, Dave Weigel, who is no strong friend of conservatives, actually put the book on the top of his Christmas list because he said it was filled with a lot of good reporting about Barack Obama. You don't have to agree with my final thesis to be interested in the new reporting I do, which is really based on diving into the archives of all of these community organizing groups that Obama cut his teeth with for years and years. And I write it I certainly have my own political view, and I never deny that, but I write it in a sort of disinterested way. I say this is what the documents are showing, and I think people can have fun and exciting arguments from a variety of points of view with the material that I reveal.
And Bob, when Barack Obama stands up and says he wants transformative change and that we can do it, si se puede, you know, he's using the Cesar Chavez expression. Isn't he saying to activists on the left, I'm one of yours?
He certainly should be saying we need to make this country work for the middle class and not just the richest people in the country. You know, let me get back to a couple of quick things, though.
Yeah.
Said.
And then we'll get to 2011.
We'll do that.
Okay.
You know, number one, I've known people at Acorn for years and years. It was a wonderful organization made up of poor people and their leaders who fought for justice in their communities. I don't know anybody who thought of themselves as socialist. I mean, that's just factually wrong. Number two, anybody who thinks the subprime crisis was caused by Acorn has got to be smoking something. It was caused by Wall Street, for crying out loud.
I thought it was caused by Fannie and Freddie, but
yeah,
that's...
Right. Number three...
Well, and Acorn has everything to do with Fannie and Freddie.
I know, Stan. Oh,
please. Number three, the John Birch Society in the 60s.
Yes, in the 50s,
The 50s and 60s. Spent a lot of time calling people like Dwight Eisenhower communists.
Impeach Earl Warren.
And, you know, with all due respect, Stanley, this is a sophisticated way to do exactly the same thing, try and use a pejorative to attack Barack Obama as outside the mainstream of American politics. And it's just flat out wrong. And it ought to be dismissed the same way the Birchers were in the 70s, at the 60s.
Well, I really don't buy it, Bob. I think I say very explicitly in the book, you know, Bernie Sanders is an openly socialist senator from Vermont. I wouldn't vote for him myself, but I have no problem with him being a senator. I'm certainly not advocating that we blacklist the supporters of Bernie Sanders. I think this is about political honesty. I think people have a very strong feeling that Barack Obama is in reality far to the left of
then
the
you
way
ought
he
to
presented
let,
himself
you ought to let
to the
people
country.
Define who they are for themselves. Barack Obama is... As I say, he's a socialist if you think socialism is Medicare and Social Security. He's not a socialist if you think socialism is taking over the means of production.
I want to see if I can get you two guys to a forum in Chicago and keep talking about it after you've read the book. How does that sound?
Got to do that.
All right, good. All right. Chris Dudley, you've been listening to this. What do you think? I mean, You've only glanced at the book.
Yeah, and I've only glanced at the book, and I apologize. Stanley, I did buy it, though. I downloaded it on my iPad today. So,
it's what an author wants to hear.
Exactly. I knew that. So I think there's a lot of dot connecting that goes on in terms of, and I said this in the first hour, you know, talking about the political elite. I think this book really does. Probably is for the political elite in terms of everybody. And I think it's worth probably looking at from a factual standpoint, if you've got documentation there relative, but taking, I guess I want to read the book to understand where these dots get connected. And to the point about Acorn's, Bob, I think you're sugarcoating a little bit. Oh, there's this
virtuous
kind of wonderful, you know, lovely people who were for the poor.
Agrarian reformers.
Yeah, and, you know, gosh, golly gee, I think there's some problems there that we saw revealed in the last, you know, 5 years that Acorn isn't quite sweetness and light that we thought
On the other hand, it wasn't what whoever that fellow was who made those videos said about it either.
I don't know.
You know, the video what an outrageous attempt to smear.
But I can tell you this: if the Acorn I dealt with during the motor voter issue, when I was commissioner of elections here in the city of Chicago, was the one that you describe, then I would still have flowing hair on my head today, as you do. Okay, I'm bald because of that Acorn that I had to deal with when I was commissioner of elections. All right, 2011. Let's get to some. Big question, are these various forces that you two at the table work with and that Stanley's writing about in his book and articles, these forces are now coming together like tributaries of a river. And are they going to get along or are they going to go off in different directions? Stanley, you haven't been at the table. I'm going to throw this question to you. From your knowledge of Barack Obama, from your study and research of these documents, do you think Barack Obama is going to try to meet the Republicans in the center of the political mainstream? Or do you think something else is going to happen? And if so, what?
I think there's going to be a two-part strategy, Chris. I think initially President Obama is going to make a series of very public offers of cooperation with the Republicans on legislative issues. But behind the scenes, I think President Obama is going to be working overtime to enact the unenacted part of his legislative agenda through regulation. We've already gotten a taste of that with the restoration of the end-of-life counseling provisions that were removed legislatively from the health care reform bill. Now, as I see it, that's a bit of a power grab, a kind of end run around the legislative authority of Congress, and we've already seen a number of moves in that direction. And when the Republicans cry foul, I think at that point, the battle will be joined. Obama will say the Republicans rejected my offers of cooperation, and we're going to be in a skirmishing for 2 years.
Bob Kramer, is this regulating what you can't legislate?
I certainly hope the president uses all of his executive authority to try and improve the or move the country along in terms of particularly the economy, but mostly in terms of trying to assure that the middle class has a better shake than it has for the last 20 years. I mean, American politics today is about the battle between the attempt of the top 1-2% of the population to siphon off huge quantities of our income and wealth. Right now, 1% of the population controls as much wealth as the bottom 90%.
And how much do they pay in taxes, Bob?
And
what's the percentage?
Not enough.
Not
and
enough.
They just got a big tax cut.
Supported across the board by everyone, you know, part of this cooperation.
The economy, the battle in American politics is about that. I hope President Obama does everything he can, as he said today, to stand up for the middle class in America and to assure that that kind of inequity does not continue to widen as it has in the last 10 years.
Chris Dudley, since you raise it, are we going to see bipartisanship in the next 6 months like we've seen in the last 6 weeks?
No.
Resulting in the, for no, instance,
and,
in
and
the
I do think
of the push
I think Stanley
casket.
Makes a very good point. And in fact, the regulatory authority of the president, of any president, is part of the checks and balances. And again, it's incumbent upon the Congress to take an eye on that. The EPA just recently. There's been some changes as it relates to oversight of
carbon.
So, you know, cap and trade stalled, and now we're kind of moving that agenda through the regulatory. I think you're going to see a lot more of that, and I think that there will be an aggressive congressional oversight. The key for the Republicans, though, is to not go crazy. I mean, I think oversight is really important, but not just go so far out there that everything becomes a conspiracy. As was pointed out this morning on some of the shows during the Clinton administration, I think so. The Republicans, to that end, the question is going to be very important on how they approach it. But I think it's incumbent that they pay attention to these to the regulatory authority and what is going on, because that's where the White House is going
to
govern.
We don't have enough time before this coming break to answer this. But Bob Kramer, I want to ask you, do you think that there is common ground? I mean, just as a person who reads the paper, you've been involved, you're part of the political elite. Is there common ground between the Republicans who have come there from the Tea Party sources and other sources and President Obama? Or, in fact, are the two actors, not to say diametrically opposed, but just facing in different directions?
Well, I think there are a lot of different directions. Ironically, a lot of the Tea Party base is as unhappy about Wall Street as the base of the Democratic Party.
So you're thinking there might be some weird areas of cooperation.
There are. Yeah, well.
Stanley Kurtz, Christine.
Politics always makes strange bedfellows.
Christine Dudley, Stanley Kurtz, Bob Kramer, all on Beyond the Beltway. We'll be back after these words, getting your calls, too. For Bruce Dumont, this is Chris Roebling on Beyond the Beltway tonight. Republican Christine Dudley, Democrat Bob Kramer, and Stanley Kurtz, author of Radical in Chief, Barack Obama and the Untold Story of American Socialism. In a few moments, we'll be getting to your calls at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. So we were talking before the break about the possibility of weird areas of cooperation between the president and, say, elements in the Republican Party, between the progressive progressives in American politics and government and the Republicans in American politics and government. Stanley Kurtz, let me ask you, based on your research and the research you did on Radical in Chief, what do you think about these areas of cooperation as they come up? And we all know legislatively strange things can happen, and there can be bills and proposals where people get on board to co-sponsor and things like that.
Well, we may find a few, especially at the beginning, Chris, but I don't think they're going to be significant in comparison to what I anticipate to be 2 years of French warfare. I think we're going to find that President Obama is significantly less willing to pivot toward the center than President Clinton was. I think President Obama's long-term hope is really to polarize the Republican and Democratic parties along class lines. And I think his thought is that if you could just make class the central issue of American politics, you could help shift debate significantly to the left. And I think we get a sign of that when we see that the tax deal is scheduled to come up for reconsideration, not in 1 year or 3 years, but in 2 years, right in the center of the presidential election campaign. And I think that's a sign that the president knows he's not going to end up toward the center. He's going to end up toward the left.
Well, there's no doubt that the tax cuts for millionaires is not a popular position. There's no question that's true.
Well, I want to Bob Kramer, you were saying in hour one that the problem in the first 2 years of the Obama administration that led to the shellacking that the Democrats took in November of 2010 was the economy.
Enough economic growth.
And the fact that there weren't enough jobs being produced and there wasn't enough demand in the economy and things like this. Okay. And you're saying, as a corollary to that, that the progressive agenda is really, not to say coterminous, but big overlap with mainstream American public opinion.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, my question then,
when you talk about the real policies and not how they've been characterized.
The real policies, not how they've been characterized.
I mean, you take the health care bill, for instance, and take it in segments.
The
people
individual
it.
People
yeah,
say,
right,
all right. My question for you is, if that is true, then how do the Democrats, now in a reduced position in Congress, how do they promote those views if they know that the Republicans, who are in a greater position in Congress, are going to be attacking those views constantly?
Well, you know, one thing is that suddenly I think the Republicans have a will have an obligation to try and govern. And I think what Chris has said earlier may very well happen. I mean, there could be a good deal of overreach that I think will characterize this issue. In the end, and for the last 20 years, every time there's been a big political turnaround, there's been a big political battle, whether it was the health care battle for, and even though we won it substantively, politically, the right won it. In the context of after 2004, it was the Social Security battle. After 1994's defeat of the Democrats, it was the Gingrich battle over shutting down the government. There needs to be, or there will be, I don't think there will question, there'll be a major battle that redefines the terms of the debate. And the question will be for both sides whether or not they're in a position to come out ahead in that battle.
Chris Dudley?
Well, the thing that's overriding all of this, let's just take away the policies and all of this. Self-preservation is going to be the watchword of this year. Redistricting is going on. We just got the census numbers out. We saw that the Midwest here in Illinois, we lost a seat. Ohio loses two seats. The shift in the Electoral College is moved to the West and to the South. No surprise there. Texas picking up four. California, for the first time since forever, picks up nothing. That being said, I've worked in redistricting. Bob, I don't know if you have. Chris, I know you have. Self-preservation always overrides policy. I have seen Democrats come to Republican caucuses to cut their own deal to save themselves and throw their neighbor Democrat under the bus. So that is something in 2010 that didn't happen in 1994, Bob, or what you, and I think you're correct in terms of there's always a crisis. But 2010, the biggest news story that wasn't written because we didn't have the numbers yet was that 2011 will be dominated by these redistricting numbers and by self-preservation of these political people in Congress, which the Senate doesn't have to worry about.
Right.
But Barack Obama has to be cognizant of because of the Electoral College and the shift
and the funding component. The Senate doesn't worry about it. And earlier in the program, Stanley, before you were on, Chris was making a big point about governors being leaders on policy, kind of the laboratory of democracy theory. And governors don't worry about it either. Governors are worried about
their... They get the stuffing's kicked out of them because they ultimately in many of these states are the last signature on the bill that passes, you know, for the redistricting. So they are involved in the redistricting process and preserving their funding.
Right.
Because you're losing funding when you lose
representation down there. Yeah. Stanley Kurtz, we have heard from Bob Cramer, the statement about progressive agenda overlapping with mainstream America. What's your reaction to that?
Well, Chris, I mean, you won't be surprised that I don't entirely agree with Bob, but I partly agree with him, mainly because I don't think it's so easy anymore to speak about an American mainstream. I think our divisions have become very real, and I think that President Obama's progressive agenda speaks for a very significant chunk of the country, but I think there's another, probably even larger chunk, that is dead set against it, and I think... People who say that the country's divisions are just sort of whipped up by the Beltway elite, I think are mistaken. I think there are real social and cultural differences in the country that we've just got to hash out, serious decisions we have to collectively make. And right now there's no real consensus, and I think we're going to discover over the next few years what those decisions will be and what the new mainstream is going
to be.
Stanley,
this is Chris Dudley. Can I ask you a question? I mean,
sure.
To your theory, is it, you know, the more urban, suburban, exurban, and as the shift in populations, I mean, it isn't, and I have not read the book, so I don't want to speak to, but maybe you can talk about that, the urban agenda versus a suburban and suburban agenda, and isn't the population shifting more towards that suburban agenda? So, you know, how much influence does the urban agenda still have?
Right. I think that's a great question. I don't actually go into that in great detail in the book, but I'll talk about it now because I think about it. I mean, I think what part of what's driving the progressive agenda is that you get a lot of single people who take years to get married because they have extended educational training before they go and do their work. And I think you see the red-blue map overlaps remarkably well with these young single adults in cities, and then they start to change as they get married and they move out to the suburbs. So that's part of it. And I think there's another long-term demographic factor going on here that is related to the decade perspective you brought up, Chris. You talked about redistricting. I think the story of the decade politically in the entire Western world is going to be the need to pare back and restructure the welfare state, because demographically there just aren't enough young people around anymore to sustain it. We're already seeing that kind of restructuring in Europe. So I think there may be countervailing forces, but there are a lot of forces that tell in the direction of a conservative future, but there are certain lifestyle forces that are pulling in the progressive direction.
Let's take that up, Stanley. I want to take that. Demography is frequently referred to as destiny. Bob Kramer, is your sense of a socially just society, including the safety nets that you think are a part of that? And I say this with, you know, real affection. Is that an anachronism? Is that an anachronism built on a post-war sense of expansion of the economic engine of American society?
It's remarkable what kind of amnesia we have. 2 years ago, the policies of the right in America led to the biggest financial collapse in 60 years.
Now, not everybody at this table agrees
maybe
with
not,
you on
but
that.
But
this is your theory, right?
Lots and lots of people in America do, and for good reason, because it was Wall Street's collapse and the unbridled greed and recklessness of Wall Street that sunk the economy. That's happened about five times in the last 100 years around the world. Every time, by the way, it takes about 5 years to get back to pre-recession levels of employment. These kind of ideas that government is bad, that the private sector, particularly big corporations, can do everything right and should be left completely unbridled, unreined in, I think it's just talk about anachronism. Okay,
but
I think that's what's anachronistic.
I think the point that Stanley was just making, not to say it for you, Stanley, but I mean that we don't have as many people entering the workforce today to pay for the recipient of the benefits of the Social Security program, or for that matter, the Medicaid or the Medicare program, as we did, say, 50 years ago.
You know what? You can fix Social Security by simply eliminating the cap on personal levels of contribution that now makes Social Security tax a regressive tax, and only people who work for a living and make up to $106,000 pay it, and people who make $500,000 don't.
What about raising the retirement age?
Why would you want to do that? Why would you want to make a guy
why would you
make a guy who's a bricklayer work longer so that white-collar people, because white-collar people don't retire earlier? I mean, that's a crazy idea. I mean, people who want to keep working don't get Social Security.
Part of the demographic discussion and kind of the complexity of what we haven't talked about tonight, which is labor unions and pensions and government pensions and how that fits into the whole construct of what we're talking about in terms of the economy.
Absolutely.
To your point, the pension, where we are in this pensions crisis, is going to be the larger discussion with the economy in this first quarter.
Coming state bankruptcies. Hold on.
For what?
I gotta cut it. Stanley Kurtz, author, Bob Kramer, Democrat, Chris Dudley, Republican, all on Beyond the Beltway. We're going to be back with your calls, 800-723-8289. Give us a call now. Welcome back to Beyond the Beltway. It's Chris Roebling in for Bruce Dumont. Joining us around the table, Bob Kramer, Democrat, Christine Dudley, Republican. We also have Stanley Kurtz, author of Radical in Chief, which is available on Amazon and at bookstores everywhere. Thank you, all three of you, for joining us this evening. And for all of you listeners, wherever, if you are listening on terrestrial radio, any of the 40 or 50 radio stations around the country, or on POTUS, which is part of SiriusXM, we love having you here, too. Our phone number, 800-723-8289, 800-723-8289. We want to hear from you right now. Let's get started with Susan in Illinois, listening to us on the flagship WLS. Susan.
Hi. A question for Bob Kramer. He kept saying that there are no cuts to Medicare and Obamacare. Mr. Kramer, do you know who Richard Foster is?
No, can't say I do, no.
He is the Medicare's chief actuary. And in a Wall Street Journal article, How Obamacare Guts Medicare, September 10th or 9th last year, Do you think $1 trillion over the first 10 years is much money cut from Medicare?
All right, so Susan,
payments for seniors, okay. And how about $5 trillion over the first 20 years of Obamacare?
Terrific, Susan. Thank you. We are wrapping up. I want Bob to respond to that. There are independent experts who disagree with your characterization tonight that there has been no cuts from Medicare.
There are certainly cuts for elements of the Medicare program that go to pay for things like subsidies to big private insurance companies. That's not the point. The point is, will senior citizens or anybody else on Medicare experience cuts in their benefits? That's what they care about. And the answer is no, not at all.
All right, let's go to Rod, who is listening to us on Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Rod, your prediction for 2011 or your question for the panel? Oh, we're still looking for Rod. We're going to go to Isla, listening to us in Indiana, home state of Chris Dudley. Isla, let's hear from you.
Okay, Mr. Kramer, this is my point. That I've already been turned down by two different doctor's offices for Medicare treatment. It's obvious that Obama knew that's what's intended for in that bill, for rationing. That's how you get to rationing. I have relatives in England and Ireland that are under socialism, and they have rationing. And I don't understand how you can say that Medicare patients won't be hurt by this, and if there's not enough doctors taking Medicare patients. Secondly,
Isla, let's hold it right there. Thank you very much for calling in.
We got to make sure that doctors take Medicare assignment. Absolutely.
But we're hearing about more and more doctors who are announcing that they will not take Medicare assignment because the reimbursement level has been decreased.
Well, actually, the reimbursement level was just increased again.
What's the answer to Isla's concern?
The concern is to assure that to participate, that doctors, A, get a reasonable and fair remuneration, which has been a big issue before Congress constantly. But beyond that, we've got to make sure that doctors understand that if they're going to participate in any of these programs, they have to take.
And how do you do that?
Well, there are a variety of mechanisms in the regulations right now. I think, look, let's be real clear, folks. There's no one I know, at least, that doesn't look forward to being on Medicare when they can be, because it's best insurance program we have in the United States, bar none.
Horror
stories you hear about that, we're going to hear dozens more from private insurance companies.
Chris, talked a little bit about that off the air, and I started to think about it, and I think you're correct in that, people do when they turn 65. However, that's when they turn 65, and then if you add to Isla's point and some of the other callers, Susan's point, that's a demographic population, 65 to whatever, however lifespan is, where you add in the entire population to that. And, again, you're taking away some liberties and some choices.
I think
choices.
We should have Medicare opt-in for anyone who wants to opt into Medicare. Anybody of any age should be able to buy opt-in. That's what I said. A choice. Personal choice. I'm all for choice.
So let's get Stanley Kurtz.
That proposal was iced. So by the United States Senate.
Let's get Stanley Kurtz into this. Stanley, how does the health care conversation figure into your research for Radical in Chief?
Well, I think this conversation, to me, indicates not that we're having more choice, but that we're about to enter a vicious circle of more government compulsion. If the doctors don't go along with the program, the government will throw out some regulations that say, hey, you've got to do this. And in the end, well, I think the public option would have been a faster route and was intended to be a faster route to single-payer, government-controlled health care. I think the current Obamacare reform is really designed to gradually pull people into the public system and eventually lead to a single-payer-type system. Of course, it's going to take some time, but I think that's the intention, and we're beginning to see that now, and it's scaring people.
Stanley, don't you think everybody ought to have the right to buy into Medicare if they want to?
I don't think that's the right framing of the matter, Bob. I think free enterprise is the way to solve our problem.
Are you against Medicare?
I'm not against Medicare, but I think...
So why isn't it good enough for seniors? Should be good enough for everybody else?
I have to tell you, Bob, by reading your book, I don't see a lot of fan mail in your book, which is a wonderful title, by the way. I love the title, Listen to Your Mother, Stand Up Straight. But there's not a lot of love in there for the free enterprise system as a way of solution. And I resist a framing of this as yes or no to Medicare. Medicare is a supplement, a safety net to the free enterprise system that has to be at the core of the way the United States handles things.
Now, I know Bob has got things to say. That's why I want to invite both of you to a forum in Chicago. You hear that music playing beneath us, and that means we've got to respond to the dictates of the clock. We've got about a minute left here. Very quickly, I'm going to ask you each for a quick statement. A year from now, Chris Dudley, who is going to be the leading Republican contender for the White House?
Who is it going to be, or who I'd like it to be?
Who would you like it to be?
Mitch Daniels of Indiana.
Yeah, and Donna Brazile said the same thing this morning. Bob Kramer, a year from now, who do you think it will be? I know you wouldn't like any of them.
I don't know. I'm going to let it
okay.
leave it
Stanley
to them.
Stanley Kurtz. Any idea on that prognostication?
I truly don't know, and I don't see how any sane person could know.
All right. Thank you very much,
Stanley Kurtz.
Thank you, Bob Kramer. Thank you, Chris Dudley. Beyond the Beltway is a Jenna B production, produced in association with WLS Talk Radio in Chicago and Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Tom Vercruz, Dan Dorfman, thank you so much for helping make this program possible. Until next week, when Bruce Dumont is back, this is Chris Roebling. Good night from Chicago.